Accession number 10934, reel 7.
General Roll, reel 7.
You know, in those days, our daily task was to fight in my area, my given area, to bring my wing or my squadron or my group, whatever it was, to the front line, to the engagement with the enemy, hit them, and bring my boys safely home. So we didn't know, we were not interested, we were not informed, this was not a matter of interest. The thinking was focused on this daily task. And when you are way out in Russia, you really didn't know at all what's going on in your home country. All these things which we learned later, you know, the trouble with the parties and that. We just say, it's not my business. I'm way out in the desert and in Russia. This was my daily task. So we were, if you want, well, uninformed. Uninformed about this, what's going on back home. We knew certainly the overall military situation, but these daily problems which you had, you learned it maybe when you were back on vacation, but how often did you come home for leave, you know? You, 1.5 years, it was just that. Then you came home, and you got rid of your uniform, and you just was in your private life, and you didn't want anything to hear about other things.
So, if we can now talk about your work with Jagdgeschwader 11.
When I took this over, from a man, which is his name is well known, Major Specht. He lost his one eye in the first battle with the Royal Air Force in the Deutsche Bucht, 1939. He flew at that time a destroyer, May 110, and he attacked the Wellington, and they shot him off one eye. And this guy flew with one eye, you know, without any depth reception, landing, taking off, and things like that. But he got used to that, and he flew in the home defense, which we had a different tactics, you know. They flew into these bomber formations in close formation. And he was led in by his wingman. Certainly could see with his one eye, but not as good as with two eyes. So, but he got problems with his eye. He got a hell of medical problems. So they took him out for a while, but unfortunately came back to the front unit, and he got killed 1st January 1945. What we call Bodenblatt, this big attack to the North French and Belgium Dutch bases, you know, in 1st January 1945. And he never returned from this mission. Okay, I took over his group, the second group in the Wing 11. And now I got acquainted with a completely different war. This was the war, the air war on its own right. It was the daily incoming bomber, summoned up to 800, you know, protected by 1,100 fighters. And we were with a small unit. And then we only could take off an order because there was a very, they weighed the priorities of, you know, we had not only the bomb raids from the west, we had them from the south, from North Africa, from Italy, also. And we were short in fuel. It came in more and more and more. What we call Reichsverteidigung, home defense, this was quite a thing. And my first thing is about that. You know, early in the morning, you got a call from your division commander. I said, okay, according our sensors, we expect a bomb raid of about 800 bombers, maybe to Berlin, maybe down there, but anyway, from this direction and so on. Where do we get it, this information? You know, we had these sensors out in the North Sea. We had ships. We had a lot of radar stations in Belgium, the Netherlands, just watching your frequencies. And in, early in the morning in Norwich, the 8th Fleet, 8th Air Force, was tuning their radios. We knew exactly how many and what they're going to do. And collecting all these figures, we could figure out that there's a bomb threat imminent.
So you were just operating in the daytime?
Yes, we were day fighters, nothing else. The night fighters was a special force, and they didn't fly at daylight. And they had different aircraft. You know, they had the 110, they had the 288, and they had the this highly sophisticated with all the sensors on and radar, and this, which we didn't have. You know, when we... The problem was in the Reichsverteidigung. We had, the first time we hit a fighter, a strategic fighter. A fighter fleet which flew 6-7 hours. This is true for the P-51, P-38 and P-47. We, an all European continental aircraft, had an average flying time of 1 hour 20. Without auxiliary tanks. Then we put a tank, a centerline auxiliary tank, underneath, which gave us more, maybe 30 minutes more flying time. But as soon as you got in contact, you dropped the tank because there was a reduction in your maneuverability and whatever you need. So this was the big difference between these aircraft, which had about the same... characteristics about the same length. You know, this aircraft was better on this area in the flight interval, and this aircraft was better on this area. But as a whole, the biggest advantage was the flight endurance of these planes. When we went up and we get in and we get engaged with them, and pretty soon you get the red light, which was short in fuel. Then you had a cloud cover underneath, and you didn't know exactly where you are, and you have to get down, yeah, and find the base without knowing where the wind you blew on top of the clouds. And this was a big difference, and you know, from I was lucky enough that in my first engagement I got a P-38.
Can you describe what happened?
I was supposed to get engaged with the fighter escort, and I got engaged with about a unit of six, eight P-38s, and I came down. They wanted to close the circle. I just got in and got them, and then I was engaged with another one, and pretty soon I had a red light and had to get down. But you give you an indication of how this looked like. I had to get out. I told my wingman, we have to get down. Underneath, there was a solid cloud cover. Yeah, this was an attack to Berlin. And down, I went into the clouds, and it kept it dark and dark and dark and dark. Jesus Christ. We were in a very close formation to get down. And all of a sudden, I broke out of the clouds. I was in a valley, tilts to the left and hills to the right in the cloud, the tops, in the cloud. The valley was narrow. It was in the wide valley. I was lucky, just come in a valley out. I easily could hit the mountains left and right, the tops. So I went down the valley, and my wingman called, there's a base. And I spotted the base. I didn't have the slightest idea which base it was. Circled around, nobody was there because they were alarmed because of the bomb threat. And we got in and landed. And I taxied to somewhere, to a hangar, somebody must come. And all of a mechanic came and waved his hand. And I opened the can and said, where I am? He said, in Goslar. That's north of the mountains. Of
Erzgebirge.
No. Harz. North of the Harz Mountains, yeah. Goslar, right at the foot. And so this can happen very, very, very easily, you know. And I flew some missions, and I got some success. And then the 12th May 44 came, and there was again alert early morning, 6 o'clock, got a call, and my division commander explained his plans and said, okay, we will join up over the Steinhuder Meer. You stagger 3,000 meters higher than the heavy fighters, and then I take you and get you in from the flanks. Okay, so we went up and we marched south, and all of a sudden here the contrails came and boom, boom, boom. And by this occasion, pretty soon in the area of Frankfurt, must have been Frankfurt, Gießen, Frankfurt, I got a call from the ground division to take over the whole unit. You know, we were 75 fighters. We have 50 heavy fighters underneath at about the altitude of about 7,000 meters. And I was up in 11,000 meters. We cruised in those days without cockpit pressurization, without air conditioning and things like that, at an altitude of 11,000 meters. I had a polished an aircraft. And they said, take over. And I was just spread out in battle formation. And they said, okay, we get down, because they had a radio failure, the leader of the whole unit. And so I should take over and overcome. And I went down with my four-ship formation and just run into Thunderbolts.
Run into what?
Thunderbolt, P-47s. And just came in and he turned and boom, we got a full burst. He exploded. They started in full fire, and then we got the next one also, and then they chased me. And my wingman, he had an overturn of his supercharger, and he had to bail out because engine problems. And so I was on my own, and I was chased by what I could see, four Thunderbolts. They really wanted to know me. The Thunderbolt is a very fast aircraft in a dive. You know, the structural strength is limited at 1,400 kilometers per hour in a dive. The 109 at 1,000 kilometers, you know? So that's from structural problems. And what could I do? I knew exactly, don't dive, but I did any other chance. It chased me, you know? If I turned the left, I'd turn into the guns. I turned the right, I'd turn into the guns. So, and they started firing on a very close distance, and they hit me everywhere, and the engine, and the engine caught fire, and then all of a sudden they shut off my thumb from the throttle. And it was about the time I decided to get out. And then I bailed out, and I had a free fall. It was down. I was from 8,000 meters down to treetop level. And then finally I managed to get rid of the airplane. And I had problems to open manually my parachute because I was tumbling. And finally I got the handle and pulled the handle, and here I was hanging on the parachute. And I had lost a lot of blood in this, you know, tumbling and just come up. And I came in a wood, which was good because it was hanging on a tree. And so no impact because of my back, you know. And I felt that the missing some pains came in, but I was lucky that, you know, a feeling of happiness that it worked out very well. I was alive. And I walked down. This was in a forest, and all of a sudden the farmers came. They watched that from the ground, and they picked me up, took in a farmhouse, and. Hours later, the ambulance came. They called the ambulance by phone, and they took me to Nassau-Lahn, a hospital, and then I was operated, and everything was gone.
Did these farmers recognize you as a German?
No, not at the beginning. I told them, hey, I'm German, yeah? And I was looking very lousy, all of blood and everything. But then they recognized me, and at that time I had a well-known name, and they knew, okay. And then they treated me wonderful, you know. I was taken in the room on the sofa, and then what do you want? I felt very thirsty because of the loss of blood. Then they got some juice and cigarette I wanted to smoke and so on. But you know how it is, if a grandfather came, he told the World War One stories, and the next one, I was not interested. They were very nice, but I was finished, you know. I was...
exhausted.
Yeah, and I pains like hell. Okay. But they were very friendly then. And then they took me to the hospital and was operated. And after a while, I went down to Vienna. When I got a cast, I got a food cast. And when it was fixed, my wife picked me up and took me to Vienna, to the hospital. And later on, I got an infection in the operations room, and which took me out of service again for weeks and weeks, being infected in this open wound on my hand. Yeah. Yes, I got an infection which was what we call wound diphtheria, you know. And it has a very, very bad effect on your open wound because there's no there's a layer of I don't know what it's really the wound gets bigger and bigger and bigger and you get paralyzed by that. But I was treated very well by an expert, and after some weeks or months he managed that and got it under control, and I got a bandage over that. And then I thought I'm ready, not just to hang around doing nothing back home. I went to the to Berlin, to the to Gallen's Generaljagdfi, and said, "Here I am. I'm ready. I'm ready to fly again." I said, "You can fly with this without wound in the operation." I said, "Okay, what can I do?" Then I became the commander of the German Fighter Leader School, which is equivalent to the British Fighter Leader School in Tangmere. You know, therefore I was taken to Tangmere when I was a prisoner. And I took over that in Königsberg, no Mark, but pretty soon we had to move because the Russians came, and I went down to Wereshofen. We were transferred to Bavaria, Wereshofen. I mention this because there was one very important chance. You know, there was in the German Air Force a unit formed by captured aircraft. All types, P-51, P-47, Spitfire, P-38, and even B-17s and this type. And this unit flew them for training, and they came to to the fighter leader school, and thirdly, I took the chance to fly all this aircraft. I flew the P-51, the 47, the 38, the Spitfire. And I got a good knowledge and compared, you know, my pilots have to fly against me. I was a target. I made the dogfighting with them. And so I could get a good knowledge about these airplanes, which were excellent. And you give you now to judge the difference. You know, we got these airplanes, particularly the American one, P-51, 38. We didn't know how long they have flown before they come over. We didn't get the papers, the egg, things like that. And they flew an hour, under hour, when we processed them, 300 hours. And you couldn't see any oil droplet at the engine. They were clean, and you could see the fantastic sealing material on whatever this. The material was excellent. And the average lifetime of a German Daimler-Benz engine was, without impact of an enemy, about 90-95 hours, and you didn't have any compression. You could turn the propeller. And considering the impact of action and enemy was about, with all the crashes and losses and so on, was about 18 or 20 hours. And you could imagine what logistic problem this had in consequence. And this was one surprising thing. This fantastic material you had, which we didn't have, by building these engines. And secondly, some very fine technical features which we didn't have. For instance, a starting system. In a P-51, an electrical starting system, you know, didn't have these problems with winding up the engine by the mechanic and all. They just started electrically, and they had very comfortable cockpits because they flew for hours. You can put a pilot in a cockpit like we had in the 109 and let him fly for hours. He gets out as a stiff man, you know. So these were very common and very good things. Besides the flight performance of these aircraft, I mean, the P-51 was an excellent airplane. The most excellent was the Spitfire. But again, with a reduced endurance, you know. Spitfire had also about a 1 hour 20, like the 109. But excellent maneuverability and particularly in the climb, the tight turns, and this was very impressive. No doubt.
But did you also find weak features which you could
There were weak features. For instance, in the Spitfire, I flew it 3, 4, 5 missions, you know. And weak feature in the, for instance, the P-51. If you get in a turn, in a tight turn, below the certain airspeed, which we knew, let's say 200 kilometers, 180 kilometers, it had a tendency to snap to the outside. And you never get it out then from a spin. This was one weak point of the P-51, as far as we knew, and as we figured that out. Okay. Then, after having been the commander of the fighter leader school and getting all these chances to fly these foreign aircrafts, which was a really good experience for me, and I really was very grateful for having the chance, certainly with German insignia, because if you fly around in Germany without German insignia, the flag would shoot you down right away. So then I became late March 45 the order to take over the Wing 300. And when I took over this wing, this was very late, and you know, there was everybody knew the war was lost. This was just a chaos coming up. When I took over the wing, I just went up by a chief. They took me up. And when I approached the airbase, it was Plattling in Bavaria. When I approached the base, the driver called, "They're down, they're getting attacked." Well, we went down and off the road, and I just saw I think it was Mustangs at that time, that just attacked the base and shut off at least 15, 20 aircraft sitting on a ramp out. This was a situation when I took over that thing. So it was not very promising. From there on, we only moved from one base, or one strip, not base, from one strip to another one. There was not very much action anymore. We had some long-nosed Focke Wulfs, which I flew also. But in those days, you know, we didn't have an air situation anymore. This was, you took off on your own discretion, and you found a target of opportunity. Losing contact with your division. Maybe the division headquarters closed down, you're still there. Then your technical officer was fighting to get somewhere fuel. And you were looking for another base because the Americans moved and you had to move and where to go. Finally, I ended up in Einring, close to this base. I didn't know that I'm going to settle here, 10 kilometers from that base where I closed down the war. And when the Americans came, we saw them, said, okay, finished. There was no spit, no fuel, no nothing. We just pumped up the, blew up the airplanes. And from there on, I asked my commanders, my pilots to come and said, oh yeah, this group, you go to the north and try to go home. We go to the south, we try to go home this way. And we got all the food which was available, distributed the things and decks, okay, and things again. This was the end.
Was this the first time you'd flown Focke Wulf 190s?
Yeah. No, I had flown, certainly not in operation, and I hadn't flown these Focke Wulf in operation. I never got in contact with it anymore. I had some flights on this, and this was an impressive aircraft, very impressive, very good aircraft, but very late. Same story with the 262. I flew also the two. I was checked out on the 262 shortly before I had to take over that wing. And the 262 was a tremendous new dimension, you know, but it came late, and there was this big fighting and how it should be used, you know, as a bomber, as a fighter. All these are time-consuming, without any action. And when it came into operation, it was too late. Out.
But when you first flew a jet, it must have been amazingly
amazing, different, completely different. You know, they had power, they had speed. There was certainly one weak point in those days. You know, the takeoff and landing phase was very immaneuverable. You know, you had to be protected by propeller aircraft, fighters in the air, because this was a very heavy, slowly accelerating phase. But once you came up to speed, you were unbeatable then, yeah? But also, there was a very slow moving of the throttle. If you move it fast, you overturn, you get a fire on this, you know, on the engine, the back, and you had to shorten the diameter, you know, the variable diameter. And this was, this was weaknesses at the beginning, you know? But as a whole, it was a new dimension. This jet, no doubt.
When you first went into captivity, how did the Americans treat you?
Well, you know, we came in masses. First of all, the Americans moved into Salzburg, you know, and the German soldiers moved back west on the street, side by side. Nobody took care for them or saved for them. And we were always moving at night, so are we stupid? Look at this, they move, they walk, and so we did. And we walked till the Lake Chiemsee. And what I learned later on, they considered all troops east of the Chiemsee and here, they are the top fanatics fighting till the dead end. And they really closed that, every road, everything. What was important was you had to get a stamp that you are released. And we came to one of these posts, American posts. You come here, you get the stamp, you know, right here. Okay, we waited. Until 1 hour, a big truck came, so I get up, and they took us back to the camp in Salzburg. From there on, I was a prisoner of war. And from there, I was taken in masses. Nobody recognized who I am or nothing. We are a mess. Whether officer or not officer, it was just a mess of beaten soldiers, nothing else. Air Force, Army, whatever it was. They took us to Neu-Ulm and then to the camp Heilbronn, which just was opened. And this was very bad. There was no tent, no nothing there, and they opened it.